Support for WPR comes from 4imprint, providers of promotional products for businesses, including embroidered apparel, trade show items, and logoed business gifts. More is at 4imprint.com. 4imprint, for certain.
It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Big algae blooms are reappearing in the western basin, sometimes the central basin, of Lake Erie.
The blooms happen when excess nutrients, mostly phosphorus, run off into the lake from farms and sewage treatment plants. Some of these kinds of algae produce toxins that are among the most powerful natural poisons on Earth.
Over the past decade, these algae blooms have been common in that lake. Scientists predict climate change could make it worse. Rebecca Williams has the final part of this week's series on the warming Great Lakes.
See the green wave? Look. Okay. Look. See him? See him stirring it up? Look at his. Look at his wake over here.
Frank and Sandy Ben are taking us for a boat ride in Maumee Bay near Toledo. Sandy's the executive director of the group Lake Erie Waterkeeper. The water out here looks like pea soup. The algae that's blooming here is called Microcystis, and it produces a dangerous toxin. Sandy Ben says you wouldn't want to swim in it, and you shouldn't.
If your dog gets immersed in it and the toxins are there, it can kill the dog, a very good-sized dog. And then we know of someone, a person, who actually became sick with neurological disorders because of it.
Cities around here also pull their drinking water from the lake.
They have to treat the water more and take the algae out, and it costs them more. It increases the cost of the treatment process.
Last month, 2,000 people in a northwest Ohio township were told not to drink their tap water because levels of the toxin were so high. The Ohio Environmental Protection Agency says it's safe to eat the fish from the lake, but it recommends removing the guts and liver and rinsing the fillets in tap water first. Lake Erie is called the walleye capital of the world for a good reason. But people who fish for a living say the blooms have made things tougher for them. Paul Pachelski is the vice president of the Lake Erie Charter Boat Association.
When you have algae so thick that you could actually write your name with a fishing pole in it, people just think of it as going back to the 60s when it was called a dead lake.
The blooms they saw in the past are back. 2 years ago, there was an epic harmful algal bloom in Lake Erie that smashed all the records. Pachelski says he had to run his customers way out into the lake to get away from it. He burned through a lot more gas and a lot more money.
You lose business. You have people that will never come back.
There are a lot of big open questions about what these blooms mean for fish. Jeff Reuter directs Ohio State University's Stone Laboratory here on South Bass Island in Lake Erie. One thing researchers know for sure is that algal blooms can cause dead zones, places where there's no oxygen at the bottom of the lake.
So all the fish either move out or they're killed.
He says they're planning to study how the algal toxin affects fish and see if the blooms change their behavior. Reuter says climate change is expected to make these algal blooms worse. For one thing, the water is warming, and that favors blooms.
The other thing that we've seen is that the frequency of severe storms has greatly increased and is continuing to increase. The storms that produce more than 3 inches of rain in a 24-hour period, those storms have increased over 50% in the last 50 years.
He says when those heavy storms happen in the spring, they can flush phosphorus from farm fields into the lake. And all those extra nutrients can put the blooms on steroids. Farmers and fishermen and scientists are scrambling to find ways to solve this. The people who live and work on the lake are hoping it doesn't take too long. I'm Rebecca Williams.
You can hear earlier installments of our Great Lakes series at WPR.org/news. This is Central Time. When you drop that newspaper or empty can of soda in the recycling bin, do you ever think about where it ends up? Well, there's a good chance that your recycled products end up halfway around the world, and that means big bucks for some nations.
The global recycling industry can earn over $500 billion in a year. It employs more people than any other industry on the planet except agriculture. Our next guest took a closer look into that industry, from America to China and a lot of points in between. He's chronicled his experiences in a new book.
Adam Minter is the Shanghai correspondent for Bloomberg Worldview and the author of the book Junkyard Planet, Travels in the Billion-Dollar Trash Trade. Adam, welcome to Central Time.
So glad to be here.
Well, there's that old saying that one man's trash is another man's treasure. And you walk us through this using the example of Christmas lights. It's a kind of a fascinating story. You never think about what happens when you throw them out. But what does happen? Tell us.
Right. Well, a few years ago when I was first really getting deep into this subject, I started visiting American scrapyards and finding piles of Christmas tree lights, sometimes that weighed several tons at a time in these junkyards. So I decided to follow them to China, and I ended up in a town called Shijiao, which is in southern China, a place where they recycle roughly 20 million pounds of American Christmas tree lights every year, and it could be much more. The reason those Christmas tree lights go to Shijiao and don't stay in the United States is because they don't have very much recyclable material in them. So American recyclers really don't have much of an interest, but China is the world's biggest raw material consumer of things that make up Christmas tree lights, things like copper and plastic, are happy to take that stuff. And the way they recycle them is they basically chop them up and they float the insulation off them using water, and the metal sinks to the bottom, and both products are then recycled.
And that's just an example of a wider trend, things that are trash here, not worth recycling in the United States, making their way to places like China or, as you write, India. How much is flowing across the oceans to be recycled in other countries?
Sure. Well, the United States last year recycled, and by recycle I mean it harvested, about 130 million tons of recyclable products. Of that 130 million tons, 40% went overseas. That's the stuff that American factories and manufacturers weren't interested in using, or we simply didn't have the factories that could recycle that. And of that 40%, more than 25% of it flowed into China, which is actually the world's biggest recycling importer and, by sheer volume, the largest recycler in the world. So it's an extraordinary volume, and it's not just U.S. recycling that's flowing in there. It's all over the developed world, Japan, the EU, Australia, and even the developing world. So now places like Malaysia, Thailand, and even some Indian scrap is starting to flow into China because it just needs so much raw material.
Now, it's interesting because you look at recycling in the United States, and we look at it as sort of a badge of honor. Cities and individuals, when they recycle, that you're interested in going green, you care about the planet, that you have virtue. But in China, it seems like it's viewed more like a money-making venture, and that's why people are into recycling. Can you talk about that?
Sure, absolutely. Well, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, in the United States, we definitely, and in the European Union as well, we tend to think of recycling as an environmental good deed. But as I often tell people, you know, good intentions don't transform old beer cans into new ones. It's the desire to make new products. And you can't recycle unless somebody wants that thing you're recycling to turn it into something else. There's no recycling without consumption, and no consumption, frankly, without recycling. So if you go to a place like China, which is actually very resource poor, and it's also very poor in the sense that there aren't a lot of job opportunities available for everybody who wants them, it becomes sort of the entrepreneurial opportunity of last resort. So it's not just about importing recycling, but it's about going around and finding the things that even your neighbors can't find much use for and sort of repurposing them, or finding the people who can repurpose them into new things. In fact, China has a much higher recycling rate than the United States and the EU, and that pretty much goes universally across the developing world. If you can't find other work, you can always go and pick the valuables, frankly, out of the trash, and that's what's happening.
So recycling sounds like an environmental win in some ways, but you write about some environmental pollution issues that result from the way people are trying to strip these goods out of the products.
Yeah, there's no question about it. I mean, I document, in one of the later chapters of the book, a place called Wenan, which was in northern China, about a three-hour drive from Beijing. It was basically northern China's largest zone for the recycling of plastics, and about half of those plastics came from Beijing, and half of those plastics were imported from around the world. It was likely one of the largest plastics recycling zones in the world, and it is without question the most polluted place I've ever visited, and I've visited some very polluted places. And the reason it was so polluted, it wasn't wasn't that people were burning, but there's just no wastewater treatment facilities for all of the caustic fluids that they use to clean these plastics before they recycle them. So people would throw them in, you know, the nearest creek or the river. And then when you go into these plants where they actually would be melting these plastics into new ones, there's very little ventilation. And so I went and I spoke to a doctor in this town, and he was telling me that, you know, in recent years, people started having strokes in their 30s and even 20s. And one of the reasons, after some investigation of it, was because they were essentially plasticizing their lungs as they were breathing in the fumes from these various plastics recycling equipment.
That sounds pretty severe. Is there evidence that those environmental costs and health costs are getting better in China?
You know, that's the interesting thing, they are. I mean, I've been covering this industry for 11 years based out of Shanghai. And I can tell you that, you know, in my 11 years in China in particular, there's been a general trend towards improvement. And there's a number of reasons for that. Number one, the price of labor in China is going up a lot. When I started covering this industry in 2002, a metal sorter, somebody who would just sort various fragments of metal into their respective piles, would be paid about $80 a month. Now they're being paid in the range of $800 to $900 a month, and it looks like it's going higher. Well, if you're paying your employees that kind of money, you want to protect your investment because they've been trained, and you don't want to lose them to sickness or that kind of thing. So you actually see the working conditions improving. But the other thing that's happening is, you know, it's a great thing. Is take for example Christmas tree lights. At one time, the way you would recycle those would be just to set the pile on fire, burn off the insulation, and take the copper away. But now, because the price of oil has gone up so much, people want to recover that insulation to recycle it. So there's economic motivation. These economic motivations are really pushing things into an improved direction in China. But that's certainly not the case universally across the developing world. And the situation in India in particular is still quite abysmal.
We're talking with Adam Minter. He's the author of Junkyard Planet, about the global recycling trade. And we'll pick up that conversation coming up.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
We're picking up our conversation with Adam Minter about the global recycling trade now. And Adam, I want to go back to those products from America that end up in China. I think you said something about 40% of our products end up there. Which ones?
Well, it depends to a certain extent on markets, but generally speaking, it's two kinds of things. If you're looking at metal, it tends to be the kinds of metals that are going to require more work to take apart. You need to actually extract the material. So, for example, if you have a factory, say, you know, in Green Bay, Wisconsin, that's just generating really clean, clipped metal, you know, things that are cut from an engine block, say, that's going to stay at the scrapyard in Wisconsin. But if you take something like an electric motor, the sort of thing that would drive your washing machine or even an amusement park ride, that's filled with copper, but it's encased in steel, and so it's very hard for an American junkyard to pull that copper out, because that copper is worth about 3.25 per pound on today's market. So they'll actually send that overseas, and the Chinese are happy to, you know, to break apart those motors, and to this day, the labor's still cheap enough where they can do it affordably. So you'll see those kinds of things that take a little bit of work to actually extract the value out go over there. But the other thing you'll see are just things that you know, that China needs that we don't need as much of. So right now, the number one U.S. export by volume to China is cardboard and paper. And that's because China's the world's largest paper maker. And so we have an excess in the United States of fiber, as it's called in the global recycling industry. And that stuff will flow over there, and they'll use it to make newspapers and boxes, many of which flow, the boxes at least, flow back to the United States.
It seems counterintuitive that it makes financial, economic sense to ship this all the way across the Pacific Ocean, and it's still profitable once it gets there and all the labor goes into it to split out the needed ingredients.
Yeah, it does seem nonsensical. I agree with you, but there's actually a deep logic to it. And that really has to do, once again, with what I was saying earlier, consumption. As we all know, the United States runs a trade deficit with China, and that is because we import more stuff, more goods from China than they want from us. So what that means is the shipping containers, which are really the means of global trade in this day and age, we all know what they look like. They're 20 and 40-foot containers. They come over the ocean. When they come from South China, say, to the United States, they come with goods. But once they get to the U.S., there's really nothing to ship back in them. So what the shipping container companies do, because they want to get those containers back to China ASAP, is they discount them heavily so that they will go back. So today, as we talk, it costs about $2,400 to send 40,000 pounds of anything in a container from South China to Los Angeles. To go back the other way, from Los Angeles to South China, is only about $300. Those containers are going back anyway, so the shipping companies are just desperate to get whatever they can out of them. But that cheap shipping is essentially a tremendous subsidy to the recycling industry. It's a free ticket, basically, and it's free both almost in terms of money and in terms of energy to South China. So it actually makes a certain amount of economic sense indeed.
Is that the answer to the question, you know, why America isn't getting in on this and doing some of its own scrap recycling ourselves?
That's one reason. I mean, the other side of that is you know, it's very expensive to ship within the United States, I mean, by rail or by truck. So to ship from Los Angeles to Chicago on a rail car is about $2,400. So that means that a guy in South China, a scrap recycler down there, can actually pay more for a box of newspaper in Los Angeles than somebody in Chicago. So that's one reason. The other reason, though, is that, you know, it's the story of recycling is really, as I said, a story of consumption, and it's also a story of manufacturing. And as we all know, the American manufacturing base has been shrinking for all kinds of reasons. And meanwhile, the Chinese manufacturing base has been growing. So when you manufacture, you need raw materials. And as China's manufacturing base has grown, though, you know, amongst the raw materials of choice is American scrap metal. Most people, including me when I first started working on this book, didn't realize just how much scrap metal in particular China uses. Well, China's the world's largest consumer of copper, and it goes into everything from iPods to your cookware. And the copper that it uses is about 50% recycled. The other 50% comes from traditional sources mined out of mountain sites. That's an enormous amount of copper, and it directly competes with the stuff that's coming out of mountain sites. And the U.S. is the top source for that scrap metal that goes into China's copper products.
You do visit some places in the United States that do some of this recycling, including, this blew me away, in my hometown of Belleville, Michigan. What led to that being a center for recycling?
Well, Belleville, Michigan is home to a company called Huron Valley Steel Company. And what they decided to do in the 1960s was figure out a better way to recycle the automobile. At the time, the way automobiles were being recycled as they are today is they're shredded into fist-sized chunks. And what happens with those chunks is you run a magnet over it, takes out all the steel, and back in the 1960s, the rest of it would be thrown into a landfill. Well, there was a brilliant entrepreneur at Huron Valley who said, we need to figure out a way to extract these other metals out of there. So we want to get the copper. We want the aluminum. We don't want this stuff in the landfill anymore. And they developed the technology, amazing technologies, to do that. What looks like a pile of garbage to you and me comes out once it goes through their Rube Goldberg of a system is individual hunks of aluminum, copper, and various items like that. But perhaps the most incredible thing to me, at least, having toured their facility, is what's called the coin tower. And this was explained to me when I went in there. The average American automobile, when it's shredded, is shredded with about $1.65 of change stuck between the seats and the floor mats. You know, it's an amazing statistic. Well, Huron Valley Steel figured out a way to extract all that change. And I've seen how it's done, and I can't tell you exactly how it's done, but it's amazing. And I've seen the piles, literally the piles and barrels of change that they're able to get out of American automobiles after they've been recycled. To me, it's the ultimate business in a sense. It's literally making money.
Well, I want to ask you, so let's say I'm here in America and I want to recycle my iPhone or my computer monitor. What is the right way to do that? And if there is a wrong way, what is that?
Well, you know, with the computer monitors, I mean, those are probably some of the – computer monitors are what are called CRTs, cathode ray tubes, and they're in the same category as an old-style television. And they're very difficult to recycle because they contain a lot of lead in the glass. And if somebody is offering to take that CRT from you for free, that's a flashing red light that something's wrong because it costs a lot of money to recycle one of those. So one of the things I tell people is if you want to recycle that computer monitor, recycle it with somebody who charges you to take it because it's going to cost them money to actually recycle it properly.
Really?
It's more difficult to say what to do with your iPod, your iPhone, all of your old electronics. You know, in the U.S., we have a very large electronics recycling industry, and they do a very good job, and this is a very new industry, it's only about 10 years old, of taking this stuff and making sure that it doesn't flow overseas. But there's a very good argument to be made that actually our electronics actually are recycled better overseas than they are in the United States. And that's because if you send an old iPhone, for example, to China, the first thing that's going to happen to it is it's going to be evaluated for whether it can be sold to somebody who can't afford a new one. And that's not just an iPhone 4S, say, which is Apple will market. The iPhone 2, the iPhone 3 have a market there. But if it can't be reused that way, it'll be taken apart piece by piece. And if there are reusable components within it, they will be reused over there in new products. Now, if you recycle it in the United States, the way that an iPhone is recycled here is that it's shredded, much like a car. And that's fine. That means that nobody's going to set it on fire for the gold or the copper, but it also means you lose that reuse value. So these are very difficult questions for most consumers to have to answer. What is the better way to do this? It's not so black and white, or we could say black and green. These are very gray areas. But I do recommend that people who are looking for somewhere to recycle, look for certified recyclers. And one very good certification, and you can see it if you look up e-cyclers around the United States, is R2. They will make sure that you don't have your phones ending up in some of the more abusive workshops that you'll see in some of the documentaries we're all familiar with. They're filmed in South China.
All right. Well, Adam, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. I really enjoyed it.
We've been talking to Anna Minter, the author of Junkyard Planet.
Coming up next, we'll talk about the changes the Senate is making to filibuster rules when it comes to executive appointments.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.